This is the BBC.
Order, order.
Hello, this is Sean Curran with the Today in Parliament podcast for Monday the 6th of November, when Labour called for a public inquiry into tax avoidance in the wake of the leaked documents known as the Paradise Papers.
Every pound in tax avoided is a pound taken away from our NHS.
The Community Secretary says more than 100 families left homeless after the Grenfell Tower fire are still in emergency accommodation.
There can be no doubt that there are families who desperately want a new home, but for whom progress has been painfully slow.
And fears about farming in a post-Brexit world.
The overall support for agriculture is likely to be much less when we leave the European Union than it would have been if we stayed in.
But first, following the leak of millions of files which revealed how companies and wealthy individuals invested in tax havens, the Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell, has called for an independent public inquiry into tax avoidance. In the wake of reports about the so-called Paradise Papers, the Labour Treasury spokesman asked the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, an urgent question about the leaked papers. And Mr McDonnell wasn't impressed when a Treasury minister, Mel Stride, rather than Mr Hammond, appeared at the dispatch box.
Unless there's a critically overriding reason for the Chancellor not to be here, I believe the House will consider it unacceptable that he's not here to address the biggest tax scandal of this generation.
When he made his statement about the Paradise Papers, the minister said the government believed in a fair tax system where everyone played by the rules.
It is this government that has taken decisive action to tackle tax avoidance and evasion and to improve the standards of international tax transparency. The UK has secured an additional £160 billion in compliance revenue since 2010.
Mel Stride said several international news organisations, led by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, had reported on the leaked documents, and the minister quoted from a disclaimer published by the ICIJ.
There are legitimate uses for offshore trusts and companies. The ICIJ do not intend to suggest or imply that any people, companies or other entities included in the ICIJ offshore leaks database have broken the law or otherwise acted improperly.
He said there were often good reasons why people used trusts.
The use of offshore accounts or trusts do not automatically mean dishonesty. But this House should be assured that under this government, the HMRC will continue to bear down with vigour on any tax avoidance or evasion activity, wherever it may be found.
But John McDonnell said the minister's response was bluster.
Doesn't he appreciate the outrage in our community at this tax dodging? Every pound in tax avoided is a pound taken away from our NHS, our children's education and care for the elderly and disabled.
The papers revealed that the Queen's private estate, the Duchy of Lancaster, had invested in offshore tax havens. There's no suggestion that the Duchy of Lancaster has done anything illegal or that the Queen is avoiding paying tax. The Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster is a government minister, and the current holder of the post is Sir Patrick McLaughlin.
Given the Chairman of the Conservative Party and Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster is responsible for, and I quote, administering the estates and rents of the Duchy of Lancaster, has the Chancellor or any minister discussed these revelations with the Right Honourable Member for Derbyshire Dales, and will he be apologising to Her Majesty for the embarrassment this episode has caused us?
And the Shadow Chancellor called on Philip Hammond to tackle tax avoidance in the budget later this month.
Will he now also agree to Labour's proposals to establish an independent public inquiry into tax avoidance? Because I tell them, if this government refuses to act, this next Labour government will.
The SNP's Stuart Hosey said tax avoidance drove global inequality.
It may well be that sheltering from the tax authorities here sums of money greater than the GDP of many countries is not illegal. But I would ask the minister to agree with me. That is precisely the problem.
A number of Conservatives criticised Labour's record in government. This was Kelly Tolhurst.
The opposition are being disingenuous in their approach. They had 13 years and did nothing, voted against measures to close loops, and really just confirming that it is only this government which will act to tackle avoidance.
The Labour MP, Dame Margaret Hodge, is a former chair of the Public Accounts Committee. She said the lack of openness and transparency about who owned what and where was at the heart of the problem.
Why will the government not insist that our overseas territories, that our tax havens have to have public registers of beneficial ownership? Why will they not do that now?
The leader of the Liberal Democrats, Sir Vince Cable, also asked about the British Overseas Territories.
What sanctions has the government taken or proposed to take in respect of those British Overseas Territories that pursue tax policies that are damaging to Britain?
As the Right Honourable Member will know, we are currently engaged in a variety of discussions with our international partners, not least with the European Union in terms of the so-called blacklist, and we are looking closely at the concerns that they and others have in order to strike an appropriate balance between protecting what are very important services to those particular jurisdictions and making sure that tax is paid fairly and as it should be.
When the statement was repeated in the Lords, an investment banker, Lord Gadier, who sits as a non-affiliated peer, declared his interest as an investor in a wide range of assets, including offshore investments.
Millions of UK savers and pensions, let alone Her Majesty, benefit directly or indirectly from investments held offshore, and to suggest that they are avoiding tax is simply fake and false news.
And he said offshore investments maximised the returns to investors, which allowed them to pay tax in their own countries. Well, coincidentally, the head of Revenue and Customs was scheduled to appear in front of the Commons Public Accounts Committee. John Thompson called on the BBC and The Guardian to hand over information from the Paradise Papers to the tax authorities. Alicia McCarthy reports.
The chair of the committee, Labour's Meg Hillier, began by asking the head of HMRC what he knew about the Paradise Papers. Had John Thompson seen them?
No.
So did you know anything about this leak and whether it was coming?
We knew there was a leak coming, we've known for some time, but we did not have access to the material which has been provided by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists to the BBC or to The Guardian. Okay. We have not had access to that. We've requested access to it.
When did you request access to it?
2 weeks ago.
John Thompson said he'd like to see the information in full, but he'd not received a reply to his request. The revenue, he explained, would take information on tax from any available source.
We had 100,000 leads were provided by a wide range of people or organisations last year. We will very, very happily take the data. We would like it to be provided to us, so that we can investigate whether there is any tax evasion or criminality.
On what you've seen so far, do you think there's anything in what's been released so far that HMRC didn't know already?
There was a long pause before John Thompson replied there was potentially new information in one case, but he couldn't name names. So Meg Hillier asked, was he prepared to look at every allegation in the papers in full?
We will look at every case of tax evasion very seriously. We've secured significant revenues from overseas, from those trying to hide overseas, more than £2.8 billion.
Yeah, we've read the government press release on that, yeah.
Sure, but yeah. You know, it's worth me repeating that because I don't want anyone to feel that we're complacent in any way. We will chase those people down who try to hide money offshore and evade their tax.
During those exchanges, Meg Hillier asked if HMRC had paid for information it had received from a previous set of leaked tax documents called the Panama Papers. John Thompson explained HMRC was allowed to make payment to get data in certain circumstances. Meg Hillier was surprised.
What's a reeling, really, Mr. Thompson, from the revelation that you pay for information sometimes? How do you determine whether it's worth paying for information and when to make a payment?
John Thompson reckoned the powers available to the tax office shouldn't come as a surprise, given the job it had to do.
In many senses, HMRC is the second largest law enforcement organisation in the country.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that many people understand that. It's only the Metropolitan Police that's bigger than us.
Meg Hillier turned to the scale of the overall job HMRC was facing. It started a programme to put tax services online and make more than £200 million in efficiency savings. And then there was Brexit. John Thompson's message was blunt.
We simply cannot continue with everything as we currently are and take on the autumn budget and future fiscal events and Brexit and then just say, just keep going.
So Meg Hillier wondered what were the priorities for the future.
Where does the ordinary taxpayer wanting to just pay their tax come in terms of where you might, drop the axe?
John Thompson said the assumptions that had been made in 2015 about customer demand, expecting more people to access services online rather than by phone, had been extreme.
In order for us to reach those on a sustained period of 5 years, we'll take a significant amount of work. And if we do not reach that, then customer services will be at some risk. And that is something we have to avoid. You've raised it with us several times. We're very conscious of that. We are beginning to see customers move. We've had this year an 8% reduction in telephony demand as people begin to pick up more and more digital services. But that needs to be sustained.
So with Brexit on the way and the budget this month, Meg Hillier wondered if he had a message for the Treasury.
Well, obviously, what I'd like is more money, more people, more power and more data. And if you can get that for me, then all the better, because, frankly, that would help me in all kinds of ways.
Meg Hillier added wryly that, with all that, he could rule the world.
Alicia McCarthy. You're listening to Today in Parliament on Radio 4, with me, Sean Curran. Still to come, a warning from a former party leader about how not to think about the north of England.
A southerner's concept of what is good for the north. Yeah. The idea that all we need for fulfilment is to get to London just a little bit quicker.
But first, 5 months after the fatal fire at Grenfell Tower in West London, only 26 families have a permanent new home. It's thought 80 people perished when the block caught fire. The community secretary, Sajid Javid, said 122 households had accepted an offer of either temporary or permanent accommodation from Kensington and Chelsea Council.
The process is simply not moving as quickly as it should. RBKC's latest figures show that 131 Grenfell households still living in emergency accommodation. Behind every one of these numbers are human faces. There can be no doubt that there are families who desperately want a new home, but for whom progress has been painfully slow. Almost 5 months after the fire, this must improve.
Labour's Shadow Community Secretary Andrew Gwynne said people were beginning to lose hope.
667 adults in urgent need for treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. 360 are undergoing treatment. The capacity issues in the NHS that we now often see nationwide are amplified here locally at times of tragedy such as this.
Labour's David Lammy said it broke his heart that some survivors wouldn't be housed by Christmas.
What guarantees can he now give to those families that they will be housed? The general tone of today's statement has lacked the kind of urgency and compassion that is still required.
A Conservative, James Cleverly, said he hoped ministers would make sure there would never be such a sluggish response to any future incidents of this kind.
Lessons learnt about the immediate response, about working with volunteers, and the lessons that the task force harvest are circulated to other local authorities via London Councils, the London Government Association, to the London Resilience Forum and also other local resilience forums.
Labour's Stephen Pound, whose Ealing North constituency is nearby, wondered what was going to be done with the building.
Local people are saying to me, on the one hand, that they would like to see the building dropped and maybe some sort of memorial park built there. Others are saying it must be, when it is no longer a crime scene, made habitable again. Does the Secretary of State have a view? And more importantly, does he intend to consult the local community for the long-term use of the site of Grenfell Tower?
Sajid Javid said the views of the community, and especially those of the survivors, were paramount. Now, the leaders of the political parties here at Westminster met earlier today to discuss new ways of handling complaints about inappropriate conduct in Parliament following a series of allegations of sexual harassment and assault. Speaking before the meeting, the Prime Minister said she wanted the party leaders to agree on a new independent grievance procedure. Meanwhile, in the Commons, a Labour MP, Stella Creasy, said schools in England needed better advice about how they should deal with reports of sexual assault.
The last couple of weeks have shown us the power of teaching our young people to respect each other and to treat each other with respect. But with 25 assaults, sexual assaults reported in our schools every single day, will the Secretary of State please fast-track the policy on what schools should do if a report is made to them, which was promised months and months ago, now urgently? I've got a case in my own constituency. I know of others. It's too important to wait.
The Education Secretary, Justine Greening, said her department would introduce interim guidance this term.
If we are going to make a longer-term change in the sorts of attitudes that drive the kind of behaviour in workplaces that's totally unacceptable, then we have to make a start in schools, and that's why we're now updating the relationships and sex education guidance for the first time since 2000. I think we all recognise the need and we'll approach that in a responsible way.
There's been a cross-party call for children in schools in England to be taught about mental health in the face of what one MP has called a national crisis. Simon Jones reports.
The MPs were considering a petition signed by more than 100,000 people calling for mental health education to be mandatory in all schools in England. Opening the debate, Labour's Catherine McKinnell spelled out the scale of the problem.
Some 850,000 children in the UK and young people aged 5 to 16 have mental health problems. That equates to around 3 children or young people in every classroom.
She said greater support and intervention was needed.
If teachers and young people are better supported with their mental health and well-being, this ultimately relieves pressures within that school and further down the system and into adulthood and beyond as well.
The government has responded to the petition by pointing out that schools are encouraged to teach about mental health in personal, social and health education, or PHSE. Labour's Kevin Jones felt the real problem lay with what are known as CAMHS, Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services.
But the real scandal, isn't it, is the fact of the broken CAMHS system, where I have constituents who, even when they are facing crisis, are waiting months, in some cases years, to get diagnosis. So it is not just about education in schools. It's if they then get into crisis, the scandal of the CAMHS system, which, I'm sorry, is just broken.
A senior Conservative backbencher, Sir Nicholas Soames, went further.
This is something of a real national crisis, and it's only just beginning to be realised the scale of what it is. And so if I may just urge the Minister to, I know will take very seriously what the Honourable Lady said in promoting this, but I do think this whole question of training teachers is absolutely cardinal to the issue.
And the Conservative, Lucy Allen, also accepted there were problems with CAMHS, but she said she was also wary of imposing yet another responsibility on teachers.
That just becomes a tick-box exercise that they can say, well, we've done this, end of, we've dealt with mental health care of children, we gave that half-hour lesson in the PHSE class, and that's finished and we don't have to deal with that anymore.
The Liberal Democrat, Vera Hobhouse, said her party had secured £250 million a year for mental health services while in the coalition government.
Only £143 million has been released in the first year of the programme in 2015 and 16. Shouldn't we all urge in this room the Minister to continue that commitment that was actually, that budget that was actually secured?
For the SNP, Lisa Cameron backed the idea of training for teachers.
If teachers can have some awareness training, can pick up early symptoms, then again we're looking at early detection. That will have such a key importance in terms of prognosis.
But the Shadow Education Minister, Mike Kane, accused ministers of overseeing further cuts to education spending. Labour, he pledged, would ensure there was access to counselling for all pupils in secondary schools.
The sticking plaster approach of this government to our children's mental health has not and is not and will be in the future not good enough.
Replying to the debate, the Education Minister, Nick Gibb, said the government was taking the issue of the mental well-being of pupils seriously. The Prime Minister, he said, had announced that all teachers in England will, after 3 years, receive mental health first aid training, and the government would produce proposals to improve young people's mental health before the end of the year. Mr. Gibb said 9 out of 10 schools already offered some mental health training to staff.
And in most cases, this training is compulsory. To support school staff further, the Department of Health is funding a mental health first aid training offer for every primary and secondary school in England. 1,000 schools should receive this by the end of this year, and this training will help teachers to identify and support pupils with mental health issues as early as possible.
Ministers said Mr. Gibb were committed to ensuring that the well-being of pupils was supported in schools.
Simon Jones. Now, at the heart of George Osborne's plans for a northern powerhouse were plans to build high-speed rail links across the north of England. Labour's Diana Johnson called a debate on transport in the north and began by focusing on spending.
Nowhere is this divide more apparent than in Yorkshire and the Humber. We are to get just £190 per head in future transport investment over the next few years, the lowest of any UK region. London will get £1,943 per head, 10 times as much.
A fellow Labour MP, Hilary Benn, said it wasn't just about money.
If we are really to have the kind of transport infrastructure that we require for our future economic development, we need both the money and the powers to take decisions for ourselves.
A Conservative, Rishi Sunak, who represents a Yorkshire seat, said the northern powerhouse was a nice phrase, but people wanted more than a slogan.
Too often, bright, young, entrepreneurial minds forged in northern schools and universities find it easier to come 200 miles to London to find a job than to look in a northern city just 40 miles away. But it doesn't have to be like this.
The former Liberal Democrat leader, Tim Farron, said regional inequality wasn't just morally wrong. He called it a colossal waste of space and talent. And he said it could be seen in the debate about transport.
We have, if you like, as the centrepiece of the Northern Powerhouse, HS2, something which I support, which is clearly a southerner's concept of what is good for the north. The idea that all we need for fulfilment is to get to London just a little bit quicker.
Well, earlier, the Labour MP Stephen Kinnock led calls for the UK to stay in the European single market following Brexit by remaining in the European Economic Area, or EEA. Mr. Kinnock argued that the Commons should be given a vote on the UK's membership of the EEA and suggested there were advantages to staying in.
The EEA membership would allow a post-Brexit Britain to square the circle between market access and sovereignty when it comes to that most thorny of issues, the free movement of labour.
He was challenged by a Conservative, Michael Tomlinson.
But isn't one of the difficulties with his argument this, that under this model we would have to follow all the rules of the single market, and the rules of freedom of movement, as he's saying, without actually having a say or an input as to how those rules are made? And isn't there a risk that this is actually not fulfilling the wish of the British people?
Stephen Kinnock said that members of the EEA were able to shape EU regulations and directives.
The idea that the EEA means rule-taker rather than rule-maker is actually incorrect.
He said Liechtenstein had used an emergency brake to stop freedom of movement before, and so there was a legal precedent for it. A former Brexit minister, the Conservative David Jones, said the UK would also have to join EFTA, the European Free Trade Association, if it was going to remain in the European Economic Area.
The fact is that what we are seeing today are last gasp attempts by those who regret and bitterly resent the departure of Britain from the European Union. It's an attempt to keep us in a halfway house, a kind of European limbo. And I would suggest that as a matter of law and as a matter of politics, this motion should be rejected by the House today.
David Jones. Now, over in the Lords, there were concerns about what the UK's departure from the European Union might mean for farmers and animal welfare standards. Georgina Pattinson reports.
A campaign by the group Compassion in World Farming against the export of live animals swung into action last year. The UK exports tens of thousands of live animals every year, and ministers say EU rules prevent the government from blocking exports of cattle and sheep. Campaigners hope the UK's departure from the EU means the trade can end altogether. But Conservative Lady McIntosh wanted the minister to understand how important live exports were.
Does my noble friend recognise the value to North Yorkshire and other hill farmers of the export of live animals for fattening, processing and breeding, and indeed racing purposes? Will he take this opportunity to give the House a categoric assurance that this live trade in animals, which is albeit a small trade compared to that in carcass form, but give an assurance that it will continue?
She also wanted reassurance about horses transported for racing. The Rural Affairs Minister, Lord Gardiner, said the government wanted to see animals slaughtered close to the point of production.
Obviously, we wish the desire for our very good livestock to go abroad in terms of breeding, and I'm fully seized of the importance, having spent a day at Newmarket, not just on the course, but in Newmarket more generally, that this is a very, very important feature. The equine sector is really important.
The Lib Dem, Lord Teverson, said he welcomed the government's commitment to animal welfare.
But when we have free trade agreements with countries such as the United States, Argentina, New Zealand, which have much lower levels of animal welfare, and in those FTAs we are bound to have agricultural clauses, won't that fundamentally undermine British farmers and British animal welfare?
Lord Gardiner said the Environment Secretary, Michael Gove, had been very clear that the UK's high standards wouldn't be compromised. A Conservative, Lord Hailsham, was worried about farmers.
Has the government made it plain to the agricultural community that, contrary to what was said by many Brexiteers during the referendum campaign, the overall support for agriculture is likely to be much less when we leave the European Union than it would have been if we stayed in?
The minister said the government wanted a less bureaucratic system. Labour's Lord Grocott said there was support for farming before the UK joined the common market.
And isn't the crucial issue about farm support post-Brexit that decisions about farm support will be made by ministers accountable to Parliament and by a Parliament which is democratically accountable to the British people?
Yeah.
Lord Gardiner said the UK could establish a system which helped every part of the sector, whether hill or lowland farms. The Liberal Democrat, Lord Burnett, had a question about standards.
In any trade agreement, the United States will insist on unfettered rights to export to us pig meat, beef and sheep meat.
Those were matters for future negotiation, Lord Gardiner said. Earlier, the Green Party's Lady Jones wanted to know if the government was looking to adopt non-chemical farming methods post-Brexit. The minister said pesticides were highly regulated.
After EU exit, we will continue to base our decision-making on pesticides on careful scientific assessment of the risks, just as we do now.
Labour's spokeswoman on rural affairs, another Lady Jones, asked, given the fears over pesticides for health and for bees and other pollinators...
Does the noble lord, the minister, agree that we should adhere to the precautionary principle when we authorise the use of these chemicals in the future?
The minister said the sustainable use of pesticides was important for the future of agriculture.
And that report from Georgina Pattinson brings us to the closing headline from Westminster. Labour called for a public inquiry into tax avoidance after the leak of the so-called Paradise Papers. I'm Sean Curran. The editor was Mandy Baker. And that was the Today in Parliament podcast. Thanks for listening.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.